The little girl said, "Mom, gray is the color of depression."
Hi, this is Rich Scuderi of Modern Design. We're on live every Wednesday from 2 to 3, and you're listening on WHCR-DB.
And we are back with more of Modern Design, and our topic today happens to be wallpaper. We're talking about that wallpaper has definitely come back. It's done in a very different way, and I'm showing you some modern adaptations of wallpaper that when I go out to look as a designer, I'm looking for things that are interesting, things that are unusual, things that really make your house stand out. I think simplicity is best, and simplicity is elegant. So if you have a house that has a lot of soft neutrals with crisp white trim, a little wallpaper in the right spot could be really wonderful. I'm going to show you one more page. And then we're going to summarize on where I think papers are at their best. Now, here's another paper that I want to show you. This is from another purveyor. I don't know whose this is, actually. It's not stamped on the back. So this is another paper that has some texture. Let's just see it come up on the monitor. We're on a slight delay, so we'll see if that comes up in a second. And you'll see this particular paper. And I specifically wanted to pick something that was a neutral sort of a tan and not some of the trend colors, the greens and the grays, but something a little bit different. Because I did read an article about color, and we're going to start to see, they say, some of the brown tones starting to come back again. So I don't want to limit us. I always want to sort of reach out to the next thing. Looks like our camera's a little bit out of focus here. I know what's going on with that. Maybe it's trying to get an image of that shot. Maybe if I go back a little bit better. Sometimes some of the patterns are not as identifiable. Let's see if we can get that. What I wanted to show about this paper is that it's a strié. It's a look of a strié, and it goes from sort of a heavy patterning to a light patterning. So I don't know if you can pick that up when you look at the paper. Do you see how the paper actually, the bend's going to make that difficult. Do you see how the paper sort of striés from light to dark and back again? That's a terrific look. That brings something else to the table, and that can certainly be done in any color. It does seem to me when you do it in a neutral, you notice the artistry of the design a little bit more. Same thing like with flowers. If you ever do white flowers, you'll notice that the stems, the petals, everything kind of stand out a little bit more. Really can bring something else to the table. So I want to do a sort of a little summary in the time we have left. Is that wallpaper is can be very useful, easy to clean, and use it today in certain areas. A powder room, a dining room, a master bathroom, a master bedroom headboard wall, all great places to do it. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful, wonderful day. See you next week, guys. Bye-bye.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
Public hearings in the House impeachment probe will start next week. Talking with reporters at the Capitol, California Democrat Adam Schiff said the first scheduled witness will be State Department officials Bill Taylor and George Kent. Republican Congressman from Ohio Jim Jordan reminds everyone.
Transcript where there's no quid pro quo.
After it's just of one witness, though, and there's others that...
After the transcript come out, even Democrat chairman said there's no quid pro quo. We got the two people on the call. President Zelensky, President Trump, who say no pressure, no pushing, no quid pro quo.
Who have a vested interest in.
We have the fact that the Ukrainians didn't know aid was held up at the time of the call, and the aid was released, and the Ukrainians took no action to get the aid released.
President Trump is delivering remarks at the White House regarding federal judicial confirmation milestones. President Trump will then be heading off to Monroe, Louisiana, for one of his Keep America Great Again rallies. This is USA Radio News.
You have a job to fill. You post your opening to dozens of online job sites and receive 600 resumes, which you barely have time to eyeball and settle on someone good on paper. In real life, they aren't. You train, retrain, correct, redo, admit defeat, start all over again. Robert Half is the better way to find top talent quickly. Robert Half interviews and custom matches applicants to your exact requirements. Satisfaction guaranteed. Robert Half, the experts in accounting, finance, IT, legal, marketing, and administrative staffing. Visit roberthalf.com.
MedicareOnline.com.
An official message from Medicare.
It's open enrollment, Fred. Time to compare plans.
Oh, Alice, we're fine with what we have.
Well, that's what the Johnsons thought until they tried Medicare's new Plan Finder.
The Johnsons, huh?
We saved on our prescription costs.
And got extra benefits.
Come on, Fred. Maybe we'll find something better.
Plans change every year. Use the new Plan Finder at Medicare.gov to compare health and drug plans. Open enrollment ends December 7th.
What do you know? Comparing plans really pays.
Okay, can you hear me? Hey, I guess it got dropped. Let's try some more. Okay, hold on. Here we go. Let's try it again. Here. All right, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, good. There we go. Of course, there's a siren goes on in the background here. All righty. Let me just get set here. Okay, so everything looks like it's working. Okay, so you can hear me good?
Yep.
Okay, good.
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. All right, so I don't really have any music that we use, so I'll just count myself down, and then we'll start.
Okay.
All right, so 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Hack 100 and Radio, show number 20. I'm your host, Jim Minadio, and I'm the president of ZeroSurge, a manufacturer of power quality filters that are used for surge protecting sensitive electronics. With ZeroSurge, you have peace of mind that your electronics are kept safe. Today's guest is Terry Virts. He joins us by phone from Atlanta, I believe. Is that correct?
I am in Atlanta in between flights. Yep.
Okay, where he's traveling around.
Travels
around the planet to promote his work with National Geographic and some of his other adventures that he's doing, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Colonel Virts is a retired colonel from the U.S. Air Force. He was a test pilot, a NASA veteran, 2 space flights, and a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy, Embry-Riddle Aeronautic University, and Harvard Business School. So you've been busy. But why we got him as a guest is he's also a graduate of Oakland Mills High School, class of 1985, which did you know I had to change your Wikipedia entry? It said that you were class of 1968.
Oh my God! Which, really?
Yeah, I think that's the year you were born.
Right? I didn't even. So you know how to do Wikipedia? That's a good skill. I did not know how to change that.
Yeah, I just went through and edited. It was on the, I guess it was on the Oakland Mills High School Wikipedia page, and I was looking to see if there's other, you know, who are the other notable alumni from our school, and. You know, you're
that's
still funny. Probably up there in the top.
That's more that's birth year, not high school year.
That, yeah, I think that's
you're
what.
You're trying to date me.
Yeah, I think. Well, I don't think the school even existed in 1968 because
no,
Columbia.
I'm pretty sure it didn't. Yeah.
Because Columbia just turned 50, so the school.
That's
probably
right.
So he was graduate, like I said, 1985, and that's because I also went to the same school, and I'm a year behind Terry, but we had the same. I could think of 3 classes we had together. We had. Calculus 3, AP Physics, and Science Research. I don't know if any
Man,
of the other ones.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good memory.
I don't think it was. It was a pretty memorable. I mean, for me, that Science Research class is probably the most inspirational kind of class I took in out of that school. Just the concept of. I mean, we were exposed to things that. Kids were not exposed to it at all. I mean, we were exposed to the internet basically at the time when we went to that U.S. Agricultural Library.
Yeah, we were lucky. We had a good school. You know, public education can be great when it's done well. And we were the school we went to was really a great school back in the 80s. So that's one of the reasons why I was able to do all the things I could in life was because of the education and the teachers I had. So I definitely am thankful for them.
Yeah, and so look, what I brought you here, too, is this show is about innovation. So we have a local effort in our county. Hunterdon County is very similar to Howard County, where we grew up, in that it has a lot of financial resources. I mean, Howard County is probably the third richest county in the country, and Hunterdon is the fourth. So it's like they're, wow. You know, so very similar. So I moved from one place, area to another. The only difference is Columbia is definitely more suburban. You have the big sprawl. You have probably 100,000 people now in Columbia, whereas in Hunterdon County, we have only 125,000 people for the whole county.
For the whole county.
So we're a lot more agricultural based. We're more like you know, like say Frederick County, as far as right. having some old towns and a lot of rural areas, a lot of hills, you know, horse farms, those kind of things. But we have this core of these technology people who work in New York or Philly area, and they wanted to live out where you could raise a family in a nice, you know, clean atmosphere with a lot of outdoor activities, and we have a lot of sports, and there's a lot of baseball and soccer and football. You know, it's all big here, and so it's,
you're selling me.
Yeah, so it's.
I need a real estate agent.
Well, you definitely should. You know, if you want to ever want to move up here, I'm big for somebody who never grew up in New Jersey. I'm like, this is exactly what the Garden State. This is what they mean when they talk about the Garden State.
The Chamber of Commerce.
But. Yes, I mean, that, and again, that's who also runs this radio show. So it is definitely a chamber.
Happy, yeah.
So they should be right. happy. But I'm a big fan of it because it's. No, we moved here 22 years ago, and so it's. You know, you didn't know that there are all these other people here who are like chemists and physicists and computer people, and you know, we're all kind of hidden in these little, you know, spread out homes, and that's what this initiative that Mark Salek did at the county was to create a tech meetup so people can come and interact and network and innovate together. You know, we started doing this as an ecosystem because the one problem we do have as a county economically is that we're getting older. So our county's right. median age is getting, you know, where it's like 44. So that's saying that everybody who grows up here leaves and then doesn't come back. And so how do we attract millennials to this rural community when millennials want to be near the city and where all the action is, you know? And so that's where this whole thing started. And so part of it was to, you know, why I have this show is to highlight local people, but also state and national people, like what they're doing for innovation and right. What they see in their industry. And it's not just technology. It could be any kind of thing. It could be arts. It could be business. I've had my financial guy here, you know, those kind of people, just to talk about innovation in their world, to show kind of a historical aspect of it and also where they see the future. So I guess for you, I mean, you've been through a whole gamut. You went from, you know, being in the military academy and then getting into the military where, you know, that has its own set of historical innovation that's happened over the years. And then, you know, and then you join NASA later. So I think, I want to look at it from, since, you know, probably you don't get to talk about it as much as like you do talk a little bit in your, and by the way, he does go around the country and gives talks about, you know, what it's like to live in space and do his work. And then also, you know, you talk a little bit about growing up and being interested in space and and technology and stuff. But specifically, like what time, like in high school, when did you start getting the idea that you could do something with technology growing up? Like, do you remember like a moment?
It was as a kid. I mean, I was lucky. My parents were not college graduates, but they really supported me, and I got a TRS-80.
So did I.
it didn't have, there were certainly no hard drives. There was no disk drive.
It was a cassette tape.
A cassette drive. They used to have cassette drives, and mine, you know, I didn't have one of those. So literally every time I turned the computer on, I had to write a program to make like a blue dot move across the screen or whatever I wanted it to do.
Right.
So I had to teach myself BASIC. They got me a camera, an old Konica SLR camera that I had to learn about focal length and lenses and shutter speed and aperture and the whole thing. No one taught me. No one knew anything about photography. I just had to teach myself. So these experiences where I had parents that supported me, but they kind of let me learn on my own, those are the things that helped me become who I was. I mean, my whole life, photography is like how I earn a living nowadays. And, you know, being motivated to do astronomy, I got a telescope, so I had to learn the constellations and figure out what M31 was, what's a galaxy, and what's a nebula.
Right.
You know, the kinds of things that I learned as a kid are how I put food on the table today, and it was that, I think it was that willingness to let me do it on my own. You know, there, there were, by no stretch of the imagination, helicopter parents that was kind of on my own, which is perfect. That was really good.
But they also supported you with the,
important for me,
with the tools that you needed. So when you, you know, you can't just do astronomy without a telescope. You can't do photography without a camera. So you need, you know, they were able to support you with what you needed, but then let you figure it out. Do you see that as a problem? I mean, I see that as a parent. Like, sometimes people don't, like you mentioned, helicopter parents. I mean, they don't let kids figure stuff out anymore. I mean, that's definitely an issue.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, look, I'm a parent, too, and you want to do everything for your kids, and you can do it a lot better than they can, and it's kind of a constant battle. No, let them do it on their own. No, let them fail. No, let them do this. Let them do that. So, yeah. If you do everything for them, then when they get kicked out of the house, they'll suddenly be completely unequipped to deal with the real world. So I think it's important to have some balance there.
Okay, so I'm just trying to think of how to steer this through the innovation kind of stuff. Like, so when you were doing, you got into the Air Force, you were a test pilot. So how did you, I guess, what did you see as far as innovation? Like, how did you as a test pilot work with the engineers? Like, how do you communicate, okay, you're flying this airplane or this experimental airplane, and say, okay, how do you use your skills to be able to communicate to your engineers, you know, whether this thing is working or not?
Yeah, so I started out actually as a fighter pilot before I was a test pilot, and one of the things that we had to do was figure out, you know, if you have this target, how are you going to attack it? And there was no, like, rule book or set of procedures that we went through. We kind of had to come up with them on our own. When I was in Korea in the 90s, this new laser-guided bomb came out called a GBU-24. So I had to figure out how we were going to use it. It was really a different weapon than we'd ever had before. It had much longer range. It was laser-guided. It wasn't just a gravity bomb. So I had to, like, brainstorm, all right, we'll drop it here, and we'll turn this way, and then we'll turn that way, and then we'll, you know, do the different procedures. And that was really cool that I was 26. I was a 26-year-old captain, literally developing the procedures of how to use the Air Force's most newest and important weapon. It was pretty awesome.
Oh, wow.
So then when I got to Edwards, we had small teams. So it was just me and a couple group of engineers from the contractors who were making the software and the equipment we were testing.
Mm-hmm.
So we would, you know, before a mission, you'd sit down and you'd talk about, okay, here's what we want to, here's the data that we need to get, here's the dangers, you know, don't do this, don't do that, here's where you might hurt yourself, and if we do this, we'll call it successful. If we don't get that done, it's unsuccessful. So we just talked through all the procedures before you did it. And there's a great quote by Eisenhower, or sometimes Churchill. Who knows? Every good quote was either attributed to Eisenhower or Churchill. Who knows who really said it? But it's planning is essential, and plans are useless. So going through the mechanics of planning something out is really important.
Okay.
And because in that, then you start thinking, hey, what if this happens? What if that happens? And then you really start to understand what it is that you're planning. But then once you start doing it, you know, once in the Air Force, once the bullets start flying and the war starts, your plans are out the door, and you just have to
improvise.
You know, yeah, exactly. So it's an interesting process of doing as much planning as you can, and then when it's time, you go execute it and improvise as necessary.
Yeah. So one of the things like that we did here, we did these hackathons. It's one of our ways of trying to get people involved. And the first hackathon, one of the things that really hit us just as audience members right away was the communication skills that are needed to present your ideas. And we try to emphasize that in our meetings every now and then. We'll have either somebody talk about how to present your ideas, or we'll practice even doing pitching of your ideas. And I think that's important, too, when you're innovating. So did you have issues where, you know, like I, as an, you know, I started out in engineering, like I thought engineering was where to go because I didn't like doing English, or I didn't do well in English class, like writing papers and things like that.
Oh my God.
And it's like now it's, once you start doing engineering, you realize you do more work than most English majors do. when it comes to communicating your ideas. I mean, how did
absolutely.
You...
Absolutely.
So how do you handle that? Like in the military, you're dealing
with everything. If you can't communicate, it doesn't matter. I'm sure I was voted most unlikely to write a book in high school. I mean, I don't know if you remember Miss Mitchell and Miss Herman.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's exactly Miss Mitchell, yeah. I mean, I had her twice. That's how I went back to her for senior year to take composition, just to try to
do
that.
Poor ladies, they just had to deal with me. I must have been the worst English student in the history of bad English students. But then, now, decades later, I mean, the whole time I'm in the Air Force, I was writing. You have to write performance reports. You just have to write about the stuff you do. As a test pilot, you have to write your test plan. You have to write your, you know, after-action reports. And then now I make my living writing. I literally just turned in my manuscript for my second book. I just, on the airplane here, I was writing up I started a fiction book, and I was writing up a blog that we're going to do, and I just write constantly. So if you can't communicate, you know, it doesn't matter. It's like if the tree falls in the woods and no one's there, did it really happen? Well, if you do this amazing thing and you can't communicate it, then does it really matter? And I think the answer is usually no. So even though I was the same way, I thought the only thing that matters is math and science and engineering, and those are the real majors, and all that fuzzy stuff is silly and doesn't matter. Now that I'm older, I realize, well, not really, but it's really important too.
Yeah, and to give
in
like
the
even
the world, you need both.
Yeah,
if you want to be a leader, if you just want to sit in a cubicle and write code, then that's fine, and that's great, and a lot of people, that's what they're meant to do. But if you want to lead, innovate, change the world, you really have to be able to communicate.
Yeah, and I was just going to add, like, it's also about how, I guess the word I learned was didactic, you know, to be able to be using the right amount of words to express what you're trying to say.
Not too many.
You know, and that's, I mean, it's hard to do when you're doing, like, an interview show, but it's important, too. But, like, when you're in the heat of the moment, that you explain, you know, when somebody, I always think of, I go back to high school, just the concept of somebody said, oh, do I turn here? Do I turn left here? And you go right. And then they turn right. You know, it was like, you know, instead of saying correct, like sometimes the word, you know, you have to be very good what your word choices is, because sometimes that makes a big difference in what you're doing when you're working in teams. You know,
yeah, and then, clear and concise. As a fighter pilot and as an astronaut, we always want it to be clear and concise.
Yeah.
You know, without that, for lack of that, you know, fleets are lost at sea. When right meant correct and not starboard.
Yeah, and then you know, you mentioned the in space. I mean, the concept that you were in this International Space Station, so now you had to communicate with people who didn't know English as their first language. You know, keeping your idioms to a minimum and things like that. So what kind of language barriers did you have when you were in space?
Well, that's a whole different set of skills. It's partially language and probably two-thirds attitude, just knowing what it's like to be the guy in the room that doesn't speak the language that everybody's looking at, that can't understand what's going on. I mean, I've been that guy 1,000 times in my life, so I have empathy for other people, and I know that's not their first language. The reason I got picked to be an astronaut was that I had been a French minor in college and had done a French exchange at the Air Force Academy. In fact, Madame Micah, she's honestly the reason that our French high school teacher is the reason that I got to be an astronaut. Because there were lots of smart test pilots and fighter pilots, but there was one who had a French background and who had done multiple exchanges overseas, and that was me. So it was a skill that really allowed me to get to where I was, just having that international ability. Look, the world's global. I'm sure folks in your county work in industries where they have to deal with people from other countries. And every tech, every large business in the world is global. I'm a guest lecturer at Harvard Business School. Our classes there are between 80 and 90% non-American, you know, every single class that we have. So it's just the nature of things. So if you can learn another language, but more importantly, learn another culture, learn their expressions, that means all the difference in the world when it comes to business or relationships.
Yeah, I had the same thing with French, actually, because I did French as well. And
Madame Micah or Madame Simon?
Both. I had both throughout the... I remember Madame Simon when there was supposed to be the class trip to Paris for the spring break, And I think our when you had already left at that point, so it was our senior year, and we were supposed to go, but then they canceled the trip because there was a lot of terrorist activity. They were bombing like the discos nearby in Paris. I don't know if you remember those. I just remember her pointing to a bag on the wall saying, that bookstore that we got this bag from was bombed. I'm not taking the responsibility of taking you kids to. I think that year that the only trips that were okayed, ironically, was the one to the Soviet Union. I remember. There was a trip there was a trip senior year. It was like they got some special trip to like the to Moscow for spring break. I remember for some reason I remember Stephanie Stoughton was one that went there.
Oh my gosh, that would have been fun.
So but that was like crazy because that was still during the Cold War and everything was just gray and just you're just going there to eat borscht and
I did an exchange in Finland and my house was on a lake and in the middle of the lake were these big red buoys and a line and on the other side of the lake were guard towers because it was the Soviet Union. I mean, I literally in 1984 it was like I lived on the Soviet border. It was pretty it was pretty cool.
Yeah, so the language thing, like for me, it helped I started out in chemistry, and I was doing I was a QC manager at a solder plant over in Sayreville, New Jersey, over on the east side, and a lot of the workers were from Haiti, and they all spoke French, and so it was the fact that I could communicate to them in French, white American guy coming to them and being able to understand what they're saying, they were very impressed.
Pretty rare.
And it made things go so much, if you had, a favor you needed, you asked it to them in French, and the favor would happen,
It happened, right.
It's just because you meet them halfway.
It'll take you a long way.
So, yeah, that's good advice, too, for technology people is to keep that, try to learn other cultures. It's not just learning technology.
The fuzzy things are important, sometimes more important than the technical.
Yeah, that's good. So let me see what else we can. Before I forget, so what do you see? I guess I want to. So in the space stuff. So I don't want to go through all the what it's like to live in space. I mean, you've done that a million times.
Yeah.
People can look up videos, and I'm trying to think of something different related to space.
Well,
I mean, you did a lot of.
I'm working on I got a small business project going on now with the Apollo flight plan, which is pretty cool.
Oh.
And I just directed a movie, which is pretty cool.
The space flight thing that you did around where you flew the airplane, I guess, pole to pole.
Right.
So why don't you tell us about that?
We called it One More Orbit. A friend of mine had this crazy idea to set a world record circumnavigating the globe on the anniversary of Apollo. This is the 50th anniversary of Apollo this year.
Right.
So we went through this big process. We got a jet that was fast enough and had long enough range to do this record, and we took off and landed from the Kennedy Space Center, just like Apollo, just like I did on my space shuttle, and flew to Kazakhstan, and then Mauritius, and then Chile, and then back to Florida in under 48 hours, and the project was called One More Orbit, so it was, it was, like I said, in honor of Apollo, and I was going to be one of the pilots, and it all came together so late. I didn't have time to get the training.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend Hamish said, "Hey, why don't you make a movie about it?" And I was like, "All right, that's really what I want to do in life. This is kind of my new passion." So I ended up directing this documentary that on the surface is about this world record. It's about setting a world record. There's a lot of tension and drama and, it's exciting and airplanes and flying and stuff, but really it's about the environment. As we go over the North Pole, I talk about the climate that has changed and looking down and seeing water and not ice. We had a very international crew. We had 10 people on the airplane, 10 different nationalities. The airplane was based in Qatar, so Qataris were our mission control. It was a very international project. So in this world that's very divisive nowadays, I talk about how we're working together as a crew. It was also the 500th anniversary of Magellan, and completely randomly, unexpectedly, one of our fueling stops was in the Straits of Magellan in Arenas, Chile, which was really cool. So that was a nice little aside. And when we were in Mauritius, we met this lady who, well,
my filming crew did. We were in Mauritius for like 40 minutes. I mean, we touched down, filled up with gas, and took off.
Mm-hmm.
But they interviewed the lady that was like their Walter Cronkite. So she had announced the Apollo mission back in the 1969.
Oh, wow.
But they didn't have any live anything. NASA had
boxed send them tapes.
You know, eight millimeter films of animated, this is what a rocket looks like in 1968 technology, probably.
Yeah.
And so they were like showing that on the air live as they were narrating what Neil and Buzz were doing. So anyway, it was a cool story. It was about these crazy people trying to set a world record, but really there were these other detours that I took. So it was fun. It was a fun project. I loved it. It was a completely quick and unexpected chance for me to direct a film, and it was wonderful. I really enjoyed it.
How long did it take you from beginning of the idea to doing it?
Oh, my God. Well, my friend had the idea, I mean, probably 5 years ago.
Okay.
But he sat on it and sat on it, and nothing happened, and nothing happened, sat on it. And this spring, he's like, Terry, this is going to happen. We're going to do it. I'm like, yeah, okay, I've been hearing that for years. And then in May, he said, hey, we're doing it. And I was like, okay. So basically, in May, we had the phone call, let's get this thing moving. So I had to work with NASA to get permission to use the shuttle landing facility. He had to work with Qatar to get the mission plan. The mission planning was really complicated. We had a whole mission control center there in Qatar supporting us. They had sent two or three captains to each one of these refueling stops to make sure the refueling happened smoothly, everything went well.
Mm-hmm.
We had film crews in five different locations around the world doing, or the credits on the film are 200 people.
Oh, wow.
So it turned into this just massive operation in a matter of weeks. So I had all these plans this summer and projects I wanted to do and so on. And like this Apollo flight plan is a different project I was working on, but all that stuff got put on the back burner, while we got this one more orbit project done. And it was fun. It was a great, it's a fun movie. There's some really beautiful visual scenes in there. There's a really cool scene with an F-104 jet fighter. And at the end of the day, it was about some of the bigger issues facing humanity, not just setting a world record. So
is it going to be on Nat Geo or some other channel? Or?
So we don't know. I've been talking to our executive producer this week. Normally with something like this, you would try and get distribution before you do it. But it all happened so last minute. Basically, my friend Hamish just wrote a gigantic check out of his own checkbook.
Wow.
As a, you know, spec, just completely speculative. We made the movie. A lot of folks, especially the streamers, were interested, but they said, look, just finish it, send it to us, and we'll take a look. So as soon as we finish up some contracts, hopefully today or maybe tomorrow, we'll start meetings with, you know, all the streamers that everybody's heard of. So
okay.
We'll see where it goes from there. But it's definitely been a learning apprenticeship for me to jump into this Hollywood universe.
We're sort of learning that too. My son wants to do this for a living. He's going to college for filmmaking. So if you ever need a cinematographer, he just started Montclair University.
Cool.
It's one of the better film schools.
Yeah, it's well known. I've been doing guest lecturing at the USC film school for the last couple years.
Okay.
Based on the IMAX movie I made in space. But
okay.
I love going out there and talking to film students and
try to connect
trials
to
that I learned.
I can connect you to this school because they do, you know, he's already, as a freshman, he just started this fall, and he's already interning on a movie coming up with Ice-T and Peter Green. It's based on Edgar Allan Poe, The House of D'Urbervilles.
Oh.
They're doing a movie of that.
I love that.
So
love
that's,
that.
He got some.
I love that book.
They specifically went to the school looking for students because they knew that they'd have the quality of the students, and his professor said, hey, go for it. And
I tell you what, we need interns. I just spent basically July through August back and forth with this editing house that was awesome in Hollywood, but I mean, we needed interns so badly. We had so many hundreds of hours of video that, you know, hey, can you get this radio transmission, or hey, can you get this clip, or hey, can you whatever, and you got to have interns to just do the manual labor of making movies, and then that's how they learn about the business, and then they get to meet people and so on. So
yeah, exactly.
But yeah, life without interns sucks.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, even doing this little show here that we do, it's a one man band thing. I have to make sure everything is running, and you have little technical issues, and there is somebody that oversees the whole station, and but it, he's not here all the time. So it's I know some of the other shows, they actually have high school kids that help them out because they can't even, you know, handle some of this stuff. But you know, so I think that's an interesting thing. So, well, that's so you have basically another career you're starting from scratch all over again, right?
It's crazy. I've got a couple different things going on. I mean, you know, speaking. I've got a book coming out. What I really want to do is TV and movies. I've got a bunch of ideas and different projects in various stages. But yeah, the One More Orbit movie. I started a small business, like I talked about. We reproduced the Apollo 11 flight plan, and that was amazing. It was a great business experience, just going through the starting a company and financing it and doing the production and the marketing and the sales and the taxes and all, just everything you need to know to run a business. It's basically been me, which was fun.
It
was
I would be remiss since Mark and I were just talking about this, the because his office is right next door to where we do this, and Hunterdon County just started a film commission because New Jersey has a lot of tax incentives for doing stuff in New Jersey.
Oh, for filming,
so,
right.
So if you need some tax breaks, you know, come over here to New Jersey. We
film
have
in New Jersey.
You know, they're trying to sell our, you know, our charming, you know, agricultural kind of scenery, our small towns. We have a lot of, like,
yeah,
river towns and things like
New
that.
Oh, New Jersey's a beautiful place. It's not, I mean, there's New York, of course.
Right.
There's the
suburban
industry and the,
yeah,
refineries and stuff, which is what makes America run. But then the other, most of the state is just gorgeous, beautiful.
Yeah.
I was just there. I was in Pennsylvania, but just across the, just
right,
across
at Lehigh,
the line.
Right.
In Philly and Bethlehem. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of those places, the old industry stuff is gone. I mean, like where you
right.
were speaking right across, you probably could see the hulking leftovers
yeah.
of the Bethlehem
steel
plant.
Steel industry.
But that's
yeah.
all just decorative, and the rest of it is like
right.
a casino and a music facility. So,
I was amazed at how modern Bethlehem was. I mean, it was a really impressive town. I, you know, when we were kids, the Billy Joel song Allentown
right.
came out, and my grandfather was a steam fitter. He put in boilers and buildings, and he always worked it with Bethlehem Steel.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I grew up with all these Bethlehem Steel notepads around the house.
Right.
And then it's just a different universe today. You know, that all ended 30 or 40 years ago, and some cities have really handled that transition well, and you know, others haven't. But I think it's better to look to the future than it is to the past.
Yeah.
Well,
what do you see?
Again, the past wasn't all that great anyway, so let's just look to the future and make it better.
Yeah, what do you see the future? Like, in the world of space flight, say, you posted something on Facebook, or maybe your team did for you. It was like just before I came over, I saw it about, you know, the fact that Congress wants NASA to use a specific rocket to go to space for the
right,
Jupiter
yeah, I
mission.
Just, I posted that when I was boarding my airplane.
Okay, so that was you. So where do you see, like, I mean, there is this issue where we have this governmental body that's full of politics, and you got to use this supplier, and you got to use our state,
yeah.
and all this stuff. And then
right,
you have the Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezoses
right.
and the
right.
Virgin Atlantic kind of people that are trying to do this all on their own. I mean,
the goal of government is not to be innovative or nimble or do new and amazing things. The goal of government is to bring pork back home to the congressional district, right?
Our, right.
Founding fathers saddled us with the system of Congress, which is, you know, as bad as it is, it's better than all the other ones in the world.
Right.
And a byproduct of that is that their job is to make giant government contracts to pay the contractors to bring jobs home. So that's an interesting way if you just want to have jobs, you know. But it's not a great way to run a space program if you need
right.
innovation and to do really hard things. And so what NASA has ended up with is some really large, multi-decade-long programs that are tens of billions of dollars in cost and usually end up getting canceled. And then these private companies have come along, like Bezos, like Musk, like Relativity and others,
mm-hmm.
That do amazing things. And the problem is they can't raise taxes, so they have to do their work quickly. If something breaks or blows up, they got to have a meeting that evening and make a decision so tomorrow they can get back on the path again. They can't afford to just sit around and wait for 6 months or 3 years to make things happen because they run out of money.
And that imperative, that fire, is a good thing. You know, hunger is a really good thing.
So do you see then at some point in the future where we just don't have a NASA? Or is it just NASA?
No.
Or does NASA become just like a...
The government is good for some things. I mean, the government's good for raising taxes. The government's good for doing things like international treaties, things like nuclear power that we're eventually going to need if we ever send people into the solar system. Mm-hmm. The government's great for the Hubble Space Telescope, for Mars rovers, for sending probes to Saturn and Pluto. And the robotic space exploration is really good, and NASA honestly does a great job. They have become very efficient. I think the robotic work that NASA does is really spectacular, and they do it for just a pittance. I mean, literally a couple billion dollars a year, mm-hmm. and America is just leading the world in every field of space science. It's really great what they do when it comes to robotics, but it's the human side that's kind of degenerated into the jobs program, and that's where if we can figure out how to have a public-private partnership to where NASA lets the contracts and then lets the private guys do their thing and stays out of their hair, I think that can be even more exciting. I mean, although it sounds kind of not that great now, given the bureaucracy that abounds, if we can figure out how to do that right. And I know that the new administrator, Jim Bridenstine, is very interested in that. Mm-hmm. He's really trying to push things in that direction. But he also, he doesn't live in a vacuum. He lives in the House and the Senate.
Right.
And there are powerful congressmen and senators. You know, the NASA's new rocket, SLS, it's not even jokingly. It's actually, we call it the Senate launch system, and it really is. So it's an interesting time that we live.
Yeah, do you see then, I mean, so we have this great exploration program. We're in the robotic world, very efficient, very effective. We find out all these we get a lot of data out of them. Like, do you see, and what you did in the space station, you did a lot of experiments, you did, you looked at the human body, like with what Kelly did with his study with the twins, and what you did even in your own body, you know, how all the testing they did on you when you lived for 200 days in space. But do you see, like, is there really a need to have people living on the moon or living in Mars other than just for tourist reasons? I mean, 'cause living in space is very hard.
Yeah, it's hard on your body. So I think the reasons to send people out into space, you know, like I went on my honeymoon to Maui, and it was great. And like they had these pictures, you can go back in the day, you had to go to a travel agency. Now you can go online, and you see these pictures of Hawaii, and man, it's awesome. The beach is beautiful, and there's palm trees. But honestly, I'd rather go there myself. The pictures are fine, but I'd rather go there myself. And when it comes to space exploration, you know, people are never going to be able to live off the planet if people don't live off the planet. So from that survival of the species, we need to send humans other places. Exploring space is important. The science that a person can do is, you know, light years beyond what a robot can do. The Mars rovers, I think, in their first 10 or 15 years, I saw some statistics. They had driven around a couple of kilometers after a decade. And, you know, like one human rover would have done much more than that in one trip.
Right.
So, you know, we can get the science return also can be much, much greater when it comes time to send people there. So I'm a fan of exploration. There are countries that don't have exploration programs, and there's those who do. And if you look at the list of those countries, I'd much rather be in the list of those who do than those who don't. But the other thing, Jim, I mean, I do love those things, but the reality is NASA is less than 0.5% of our federal budget, and we have some really serious problems. The debt that we have is the 21st century security issue for the whole globe. We need to figure out how to make electricity without making pollution.
Right.
You know, cancer just kills huge numbers of people. And so I think we have some really big problems here on Earth that you can get benefits from space. If you have a really hard challenge that you have to overcome, you will learn things that you wouldn't learn otherwise. And so there are practical benefits that you can get from space travel down here on Earth. But when it comes to spending the big dollars, if I were president, I would try and solve
the local issue
and the electrical problem,
right?
And I would put a concerted effort into cancer research, because those are the things that really affect people in our daily life.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, you know, the other fun thing that I mentioned it one of my other shows because when I started doing this program, I do more like news analysis kind of things. And one article that hit me kind of as an interesting little side thing is how are we going to keep track of time when people are living in Mars? Because it's like a different calendar. It's a different, you know, humans have this, we have this need to be able to mark time. And even the fact that, you know, even just communicating to Mars, like the whole, you know, the movie The Martian, like how they able to communicate all this stuff so much faster than it really happens. Because light takes, what, 2 or 3 minutes to get to Mars?
Or you know. 10 or 20 minutes, depends on orbits.
You know, okay,
if
right.
If Earth is near Mars or Earth is far from Mars, I think it can be up to 20 light minutes away. Yeah, because the sun is 9 light minutes, and Mars.
Oh yeah, if you're on the other side of it, yeah,
20. Yeah.
So I mean, they have to keep like so. It was like it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek article, but it is kind of a thoughtful thing. It's like, you know, you think we're going to be living in Mars in the next 20 years. We can't even figure out what time system we're going to even use.
Yeah, the time would be really hard. And if you try and shift to it's a 24-and-a-half-hour day there.
Yeah.
And human bodies were not designed to work on 24-and-a-half-hour days. And the Mars rover teams on Earth have tried to do that, have tried to adjust themselves, and it just kills them.
Oh, wow. So that extra half hour makes that big of a difference.
That's a big problem for humans when they go to Mars. You know, what clock do you set?
Yeah. So I thought that was
interesting. Well, hey, I've got a flight to catch.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. This is just about the right time to end the show anyway.
Okay.
I usually what I do is I end with a little story. You don't have to stick around with that. I looked up the creation of the formation of NASA, like the story of how it happened back in the 50s.
Okay.
So I like to end the show with some kind of historical thing just to give everybody perspective on what we've been talking about. So I appreciate you coming on the phone with me and have safe travels. And if you're ever in New Jersey, definitely we'll have to get you here or maybe even for one of our tech meetups. Maybe we could do more of a Skype thing one day for the bigger group. So,
Sounds good.
I'll keep in touch. And were you able to say hi to our mutual friend there in California yet, or he hasn't contacted you? Mr. Ghostagore?
I have not seen him. We texted briefly. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. I want to make sure he made it.
Yeah. That's been a couple weeks. I forgot about that.
Okay, yeah. I did text the other day just to make sure you guys connect. So, all right. Well, have a safe flight, and thank you for your time.
Thanks. We'll talk later.
Okay. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All righty. So, let me get a water here a second. All right, so as we wind down here, again, I promised a little story about NASA. So on basically what happened was in 1958, Congress passed legislation establishing NASA to exist as a civilian agency responsible for coordinating Americans' activities in space. So what happened was, for those of you who don't remember or weren't around, back in the 40s, what happened was there was a group called the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, and they were in charge of doing all the experimental aircraft. So the Bell X-1 that broke the sound barrier, that was all done under this NASA with a C. or NACA organization. And so everything was, you know, we're still innovating under that umbrella. And then Sputnik happened. So the Russians, the Soviet space program, they launched the first artificial satellite deemed Sputnik number 1 on October 4th, 1957. And that freaked out the United States. So basically we said, all right, we better get to it because this is a national security crisis. This is a technology crisis. And we were quick to act. So President Eisenhower counseled for a while, and they figured out that we should have some kind of advanced space agency. And so in 1958, they created the National Aeronautics Space Administration. On January 12th, it was... January 31st. So, January 31st, we launched our first satellite, Explorer number one. So, it was consisted of a payload from the Iowa Cosmic Ray Instrument. The Iowa Cosmic Ray Instrument was loaded without a tape recorder, which was not modified in time to make it onto the satellite. So, again, we just rushed something into space to be able to say we were able to do it, too. So, and then the rest is history with the, Kennedy speech about getting us to the moon by the end of the decade. So that's how NASA got started. And I think we're at the end of our show here, so... let me get my usual thank yous. Just some news real quick. Again, we have the Hack Hunter to meet up on the 21st, not the 28th, because that's Thanksgiving. So come out. It's at the Lone Eagle Brewing Company. Let's see. So thank you to Terry for being my guest. Thank you to all the new fans that watched on Facebook and YouTube. Thank you to the Chamber for giving me the opportunity and the platform. Mark and his team at Economic Development for their encouragement and support. The gang back at Zero Search, Donna, Deb, Jen, Tony, Dave, and John. And thanks to my wife, Debbie, and kids, Cora, Nick. And to all the rest of you innovators out there, the original meaning of innovator was that you are a rebel. So keep rebelling against the doubters and make your ideas a reality.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Trump is praising his choices for the federal bench.
My administration and Republicans in Congress have now confirmed more than 150 federal judges.
Speaking at the White House, the president also says that the numbers keep rising and the figures represent quality and quantity. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine is signing a bill into law that will strengthen amusement park ride inspections and safety. The bill creates Tyler's Law, a measure named after 18-year-old Tyler Gerald, who died when a ride broke apart at the Ohio State Fair in 2017.
Certainly out of this horrible tragedy, there's been some good come, and that is a renewed scrutiny on how our rides are inspected.
The Republican governor speaking in Columbus. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
So there's this guy named Jordan, and he's a healthy guy. He's a dad of six, and he works as a guide in Alaska. But then he goes to the doctor, and he's diagnosed with cancer, stage 4. And here's the thing. He had switched from medical insurance to MediShare, which is a Christian healthcare sharing ministry. So the question for Jordan and his wife Jenny was, is this really going to work?
Our medical bills exceeded $160,000. MediShare members shared all our bills.
And it was about more than just the money, too. This is a real community.
MediShare is a family, a group of people that stick with you through the hardest times of your life. I just don't know how I could have done it without MediShare.
It's so worth looking into. There's a reason this is growing so fast. If you want to find out more, here's a number for you. 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
Minnesota Senator and presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar signed up for the New Hampshire primary on Wednesday and called upon voters to vote for her no-nonsense politics.
If they're tired of the noise and nonsense, they've got a home with me, and that I am someone that has consistently governed by bringing people with me and not by shutting them out.
The New Hampshire primary is the first in the nation. USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes has an update on 9 American citizens who were murdered in northern Mexico.
An arrest has been made in connection with the brutal murders of 9 members of an American family who were traveling through Mexico. 3 women and 6 children were shot and then burned after their vehicles were ambushed by a drug cartel on Monday. The victims part of a fundamentalist Mormon community just south of the border. Mexican law enforcement says the suspect was heavily armed and was holding 2 hostages when he was captured.
And you're listening to USA Radio News.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less, guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
Republican Senator from Kentucky Rand Paul defended his call for media outlets to reveal the name of the Ukraine whistleblower, adding they should come forward. Paul was asked on Fox News to reply to a tweet from the whistleblower's attorney that stated if Congress does not protect his client's anonymity, their safety will be jeopardized.
You know, I don't wish harm on anyone. I've been the victim of political violence.